You are listening to the Quest for Wholeness podcast, a biopsychosocial spiritual guide. If you're interested in the human experience, health, wholeness, and how everything is interconnected, then you are in the right place. In this show, we will explore the interconnected realms of health that lead to whole human beings. My name is Lexi Burz, and I'm passionate about holistic well-being, longevity, and am armed with an education in psychology. I'm so grateful to have you here with me. Welcome to A Quest for Wholeness podcast. Coming up on A Quest for Wholeness podcast.
Dysregulated people do not know they're dysregulated. And I think it all comes back to, you know, we don't know what we don't know. So showing them, you know, the research, showing them and modeling what it could look like, giving them hope that things can improve without putting blame and shame on them. And I think just guiding, mentoring, we often think that adults should know better. How would an adult know better if they don't know better?
Dr. Heather Saunders, an accomplished family mediator with over 3 decades of experience, is dedicated to effective communication and resolution within families. With a background in education spanning 30 years, she brings invaluable skills to mediating complex family issues. Heather prioritizes open, empathetic communication, creating safe environments where parties can express concerns and collaborate for solutions. Recognized as an accredited family mediator by Family Mediation Canada, she upholds high ethical standards. Outside work, Heather enjoys yoga, hiking, and family time, reflecting her commitment to well-being and family bonds. With degrees from the University of New England, Yorkville University, and the University of New Brunswick, all in education, Heather stays current with ongoing professional development. She's a trusted choice for sensitive family matters, dedicated to fostering positive outcomes. Heather, or fondly known as Dr. Mom, is the beloved mother of my dear friend. Whenever this friend is in town, we all gather at Heather's beautiful house in the woods and get spoiled with fires, food, and hot tubs. Heather's care and compassion is electric. I consider myself truly blessed to have the privilege of knowing someone as remarkable as her and having her on my podcast. Here we go with Dr. Heather Saunders. All right, Dr. Heather, welcome to the show. I'm so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you, Lexi. I am excited to be here.
Awesome. So you were just talking a bit about mindfulness to me, and you said something very interesting, that mindfulness as the suspension of judgment. So using mindfulness to inhibit our judgment. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, to me, I believe that mindfulness is all about suspension of judgment. And if we as human beings truly want to connect with others, then we need to suspend our judgment in conversations, upon meeting, just first reactions, not judging a book by its cover, but stepping back, parking those personal biases that we all have, and just being open to learning something new, being curious. I like to start every day thinking, what will surprise me most today? And my family will say, you do not like surprises, Mom. I do like to be surprised by people. I'm fascinated. So that's something. Mindfulness, I think, is key to every human connection you will ever make.
I love that too, because I think if we can approach things with curiosity rather than judgment, that's opening up the possibilities of, you know, developing relationships or even just for different things to happen in our daily life.
True. I think, you know, if we have a closed mind going into anything, we are not going to establish or make those so important connections.
And in your line of work, as a family mediator, I'm sure that is at most important for you to approach those situations open and compassionate. So on that line, what are some common triggers that underlie the factors that lead to familial conflicts?
That's a really good question, Lexi. I think a lot of family high conflict, and if I just speak to high conflict, it can be quite cyclical in nature, where people have never learned the skills to self-regulate. They have modeled everything from their parents and grandparents. So as a family mediator, I see my job more as an educator to learn about where they're at in their journeys, but also to teach them about self-regulation, about empathy, attention, respect when listening to one another. Oftentimes, they're so busy talking, they're not hearing, they're not listening. And I think that's the most important thing is that they really start listening to one another. But with that said, self-regulation itself is a skill that you have to learn at a very young age. And if you are always in a high conflict situation and have never been taught how to self-regulate, why would you, as a 45-year-old, know how to self-regulate? How would you be able to teach your children that? So I think that is the biggest thing in mediation is the conflict and finding out where is it coming from and how can we bring it down. And I think about, the prefrontal cortex, the reptilian brain, all of those neurosciences, the approaches, the neuroplasticity, believing that these people can learn, can do better, and that their relationships will improve. And again, being the best ancestors they can be for their family. That was a
So
long
in
answer, Lexi.
there's lots to dig in there, and I'm so excited. So in a mediation session specifically, how do you approach to uncovering and addressing those specific things? Like, maybe somebody hasn't ever self-regulated and hasn't modeled that. So that's landed them in this high conflict situation because it could be pretty. It could feel quite isolating and maybe confrontational to bring this up with somebody who maybe hasn't even had the awareness that these things are causing their situation. So how do you approach that and uncover and communicate with them about these things?
Well, I think a very good approach is to not say you are dysregulated. And I think that having the skills to calm people down, and again, you cannot say calm down, but just valuing them and using, Bill Eddy's ear statements that you can interrupt some of that dysregulation during a conversation with that empathy, attention, and respect. And when they know you're listening to them, oftentimes that will bring them down. And letting them talk, but also being able to distract them from, I would say getting into that spiral. And knowing when to stop that spiral. I'm not sure if I'm really answering your question, but I think dysregulated people do not know they're dysregulated. And I think it all comes back to, we don't know what we don't know. So showing them, the research, showing them and modeling what it could look like, giving them hope that things can improve. Without putting blame and shame on them. And I think just guiding, mentoring, we often think that adults should know better. How? Really, how would an adult know better if they don't know better? So I think that just, there's so many, just supporting them, letting them know that someone cares. That's where a lot of hope comes from, and letting them know the impact that this conflict is having on their own health. Before we even talk about the family health, that the adrenal fatigue this person must feel. And I think just, letting it be about them while they navigate this really new and uncertain terrain. This is all new for them. It's just, it's discomfort. Nobody's ever shown them a different way.
And just as we support kids that way, of putting our attention on them and supporting them through whatever big emotions are coming up, if no one ever did that for you as a child, it's almost like that person needs to go back to that state and have that loving, kind, supportive, empathetic nature directed to them, perhaps for the first time in their lives.
Yes, yeah. And being a grandmother, I think that there's some sort of trust when you tell people you're a grandma, that they're like, oh, this could be safe to tell her things. And I don't even know what that is, because I think there are a lot of terrible grandmas out there. But it gives some credence to how old I am, I think, and that maybe there's some wisdom.
Some credibility
A little bit, yeah.
on top of your bachelor's degrees, master's degree, PhD, and years of experience.
Yes.
I wonder, let me see if I could position this question well. Who are the type of people that seek out mediation services? I know your organization works with people who are going through divorces or, as you mentioned, high familial conflicts, but what is this demographic? Who are these people?
Well, unfortunately, it's usually higher socioeconomic people. Going through change is not affordable for a lot of families. The families who need it most are not getting the support. Typically, we would see people who are going through a separation, getting ready to get things in order, how to divide things up, parenting plans. So with that, you're looking at a lot of 35 to 50-year-old couples. I would really like to focus my practice on, that parenting plan, parenting coordination, working with both parents to support their family. And it doesn't have to be, people with young children either, that we know couples who are going through gray divorces, that it really tears the family apart, no matter what the ages of the children are. So right now it would be a lot of, people with children, at an age where they need parenting plans. But I'm hoping that, I can tap into even teenage mediation with their parents. A huge gap where parents don't know how to parent teenagers. And oftentimes when the teenager leaves before becoming an adult, that fractured relationship can never be repaired. So I really would like to work more, focusing on child advocacy, children being 0 to 50, really. Those missed steps that some people didn't get as a child and the training they
Again,
need.
a response with so much that we can dig into. And I would love to talk about those relationships, the parenting plans that have children. I was just reading a new book last night. It was called What Happened to You? It was co-authored by Dr. Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey, actually. And so the title, I was kind of off guard by the title, but it was that transition from What's Wrong with You? To what happened to you to make you the way that you are. So once I read that, I was like, okay, I can get on board with that. But so Dr. Bruce Perry, I believe he's a child psychiatrist and studied a lot on the impacts of trauma on the brain in children. And he was saying that a parent couple breaking up to a child who's younger, even 12 and under, can almost be the same as like a loss of a person. They're grieving that because they've never seen their parents as separate individuals. They've always seen the parent as one person, essentially. So, how does that sort of manifest in the work that you do?
I love that approach that, the unit, seeing a child only sees their parents as a unit. Really, that is truthful, even after the separation. I think for me, what has been amazing, and even as an educator, when we had parents who were transitioning into one home to two homes, they didn't know the impact it had on the children. And
Yes.
children are really, really good at telling the parents what they think the parents want to hear and what they want to see. Parents are really good at seeing what they want to see and not looking for the really that grocery list of trauma items they should be looking for. So, there's a lot of ignorance on the part of parents, children doing what they need to survive, parents not recognizing that the children needs more than a little bit of counseling. And I think, children are, we talk about the resiliency, but we don't talk about interrupting trauma with children. And trauma can be interrupted. There are many stages of trauma where, if it could be identified early on and being proactive as a parent going through a separation, you could have those steps in place ahead of time. The child's still going to be impacted, but the amount of residual trauma can be minimized by parents who really think about the child first and not what they need or what they want. I think their mental health is obviously important, but that child's mental health is more important. If I could go back in time, Lexi, there's so many things I would do differently as a parent going through a separation. And I'm well practiced because I've gone through it a few times. But I didn't know, and I didn't have the skills, and there was no place to go and get that education.
And I know you said the ignorance on parents, and I know what you mean, but just to clarify, you don't know what you don't know.
Correct.
Ignorance is not a derogatory term here, but it's just the lack of awareness of the impact that it's having.
Correct. Yes. I do believe parents want the best for their children. In 32 years of being a teacher, I can recall on one hand how many parents I thought did not really love their children. And all of the other thousands and thousands love their children very, very deeply.
I think this brings us nicely into ACEs or ch adverse childhood experiences because, again, you don't know what you don't know. So, if parents don't even know about these ACEs, and I feel like a lot of people don't know about ACEs, then they you can't be aware that they're happening or even mitigating them in the forefront of it. Or on the after effects. So maybe you could share with us a little bit more about adverse childhood experiences and how these impact family dynamics.
Well, there's so much fascinating research that's been done around adverse childhood experiences just in the past decade, and it's so relevant. A lot of people think of ACEs as being, in poverty-stricken, low economic areas. I've seen adverse childhood experiences in some of the most wealthiest families in Canada. Understanding that neglect is part of ACEs. You can give a child as many toys, as much technology as you want, but if they're not interacting in a positive way with an adult model, that is a sort of trauma because they're not getting the guidance, they're not being validated. When we look at, other more common ACEs, we know about poverty. Nutritional requirements. And we know if you don't get the right nutrition, even as a newborn, it's going to impact your bodily, your organs, everything for the rest of your life. Those children who are growing up in high conflict families, what that does to them, because they are always on guard. People who don't have a safe place to live. People who are constantly, sending their kids out into an unsafe environment, because it's necessary, but the child is again hypervigilant about their surroundings. ACEs will impact children for life in so many ways that they don't even know that they're being impacted either.
So if these are going on, and I think this is a great place to bring in kind of what you mentioned about your hopes for teenage mediation and child advocacy, is if these things are going on, the likelihood of a child growing up and potentially leaving the home early is definitely increased. Is that correct?
Yes. And what we know about teenagers who have to survive on their own, it's difficult. I mean, your life of poverty will continue. You're not going to get the supports. You won't even know where to go to get the supports. It's definitely a downward spiral for a lot of kids who have to leave their homes due to conflict, safety, so much abuse and things that are going on in homes. And I think that, there should be safer spaces in every community for every child.
Do you see ACEs coming up in the work that you do? And if so, how do you educate and address them with parents or caregivers?
That's a good question. I don't think there's ever been a time that I've actually addressed ACEs with a parent. Again, giving something a label can be very intimidating for so many people. And we have to be careful of the words we use when educating people, because again, it's
Absolutely.
blame and shame. And I think, we provide parents with a lot of research. Parents can discount that research, but I think when they see that people are invested in protecting children, and creating more protective factors, they may buy into it more. And again, if it benefits them, they will buy into it more as well.
I always think a lot of people say, children don't come with a manual. There's not a book on how to be a parent, but there is quite a lot of research and resources out there for people.
Yes, and there are many, many, many books that have been written about how to parent. It's funny, I think maybe it's kind of like teaching, Lexi. A lot of people, most people we know have gone to school. And most people will say, I know what it's like to be a teacher because they've been with teachers their entire lives. But do they really know what it's like to be a teacher? No. And most parents only remember high school as being their last formative education before higher education. And they think that the kid in grade one is the same as they were in grade 12. So there's a huge disconnect with parents even being able to remember what it was like to be a child. I think it's important for parents to sometimes realize that they're, doing the best they can, but just because they had parents, that doesn't mean they know how to parent. It doesn't even mean that their parents knew how to parent. And I oftentimes you hear the expression, well, I turned out okay, but could you be better?
I think something that we're dancing around, we're kind of dipping our toes in here, is the idea of intergenerational trauma as well,
Yes.
and how that impacts future ACEs from occurring, just to tie in the concepts we're talking about here. But I don't know if listeners may have heard about intergenerational trauma before. I know it's very commonly brought up in terms of our Indigenous peoples in Canada, but could you share a little bit with us about intergenerational trauma?
Well, ask me something more specific.
Good question. I guess for parents or individuals even coming into mediation services who are experiencing high conflict in their lives, replaying the same patterns over and over and over again that may be embedded from their parents, grandparents, even great grandparents too. How do you support them to intervene into those patterns and gain awareness and mindfulness? Because that's the first step before making any change.
True. Awareness before action. Are you familiar with Meserov's transformation theory?
No.
So it really guides everything when you think about change. And in order for true change or transformation to happen, you need a disorienting event. Something has to shake your foundation in order for you to think about making change. And with people coming into mediation, we could easily say, well, you're here, obviously there's a problem. They don't know there's a problem. They don't know that their high conflict relationship is any different than anybody else's. And oftentimes when we share stories with our friends are not always honest and say, I know exactly what you're going through. Well, no, they don't. So we have people who are high conflict, and you have to get them to acknowledge they're at a point that it is a disorienting dilemma. They need help. They have to acknowledge that in order to move on and change their practices, they need to start looking at things in a different way. And I think, as a mediator or an educator, or even as a parent, you really have to be honest with people and gain that trust and let them know that you're still going to be there to support them when they have that aha, I need to change. I need to do something different to stop this crazy merry-go-round that I'm on and dragging my kids along with me and my potential future partners and maybe future children and grandchildren. Like, let's stop the crazy train. Get off. Let's, plan everything and then get on a different train. I know that's a terrible analogy, Alexei.
Well,
But I
that's
think, it is
pretty.
the disorienting dilemma that people need something to shake them.
And that's pretty profound when you put it that way, impacting future relationships, our future relationship with self, our future opportunities, our future children. I'm sure that would help people potentially come to realize the ramifications that the way that they are has on potentially the rest of their lives.
Yes, we're not very good at changing as human beings, or we think we're not. However, I always say, if you don't change, you die. Like, you really have to evolve.
And adapt.
Yes.
And I think this is an interesting direction I wanted to go and talk about kind of the way that our society is set up that influences familial conflict or just conflict in general and also hides it. Because as you mentioned, people aren't always truthful about what's going on. And I feel like, again, this common phrase that I've heard, like, you never know what's going on behind closed doors, but people keep those doors closed and they don't tell other people because of blame, shame, what have you. But how is that something you address in mediation sessions? How our society shapes our relationship to conflict and hiding it and the shame that's produced?
I like that question. And I think that talking to people in mediation about socialization is key. Sometimes they don't even know they've been socialized to do certain things, to think in certain ways, to dress in certain ways. I think as women, we have been socialized to try to be superwomen, to not ask for help because it was a sign of weakness. And I think we need to ask for help. We are probably the only culture, when I think about Canada and the United States, that we live in isolation away from friends and family. We run off, get a house, put our children in there, and try to do everything without having that extension of community and just being able to ask, can you come over? I need a break. I don't know if you've watched Lessons in Chemistry.
No, I
Oh,
haven't.
highly recommend. Very independent woman who has a newborn, and has to learn how to ask for help. And I, it resonated with me because that's almost all women.
That's right.
Even when you have a spouse or a partner who's there to help, we still take on too much. We need to ask for help. So that's part of socialization that women need to work on, and stop, conforming to what societal norms are. And I think that's a big part of mediation for people to let go of the stereotypes that we've been raised to do, to think, stop cooking for your spouse. If you're tired, don't cook. There's so many things, but as women, we are very highly attuned to feeling that that's the expectation of us or we will fail. So that's part of, societal norms, socialization, and just understanding that every family is unique. You don't have to look like the family next door. You don't have to have the same experiences as the family next door. Create your family based on a foundation of love, respect, integrity, and stop worrying about all of the other things that we often worry about that just doesn't serve us well.
Again, there's the societal influence too of just what you should be keeping up with the Joneses, doing this, going on this vacation. And I love that you mentioned that about building your own foundation on love and respect and really what your own values are and what your own family unit's values are, because those are going to look very different from your next door neighbor, and in turn your behaviors and your actions and the things that you do in life are going to look very different as well.
And really stop caring so much about what other people think about what you're doing. If you're doing the right thing and doing it from the right place, that's what you should care about.
We can say that twice. I wanted to go back because I think you brought up about specifically in our North American society, we live in a very hyper individualistic culture where, as you mentioned, we get married and then we all go in our own houses and we have our own days and then we don't see people or have that network that we can rely on, that community. However, I feel like there could be a challenge there. Even if people want to support their family, have more family engagement, have more engagement with the people in their lives, if they're in a state of such dysregulation, that could potentially be a battlefield for more conflict. So I guess my question there is if somebody really wants to cultivate a collective culture of their own, prioritizing relationships, but they've dealt with adverse childhood experiences or trauma or are the result of intergenerational trauma. How do you begin to even navigate that space?
Well, that's a really tough question, Lexi. I think about advertising, and I believe, and I'm going to circle back to you, trust me, hang in there. That everybody should have a connection to technology. I believe that is a right of every Canadian. Unfortunately, it still isn't happening. But having those ads, having things that garner people's attentions at their fingertips, the government could be putting more things into place in each community to reach out to these people. Now that we do, like we're doing, a little virtual meeting, or we can have a virtual doctor's appointment, these could be places where people could start in a safe forum to actually meet with someone to find out what are the next steps. We have so many trained people in Canada who can help people who are coming from that trauma-informed background. And I think when they have that awareness that they're ready to take action, there has to be something available at their fingertips to say, I'm ready. And it needs to be instant or somewhat instant, because people don't like waiting. People are impatient. And that's part of our society too. But I think we have to respond to that.
That's reminds me of another guest that I had on, Kev. He's currently doing his PhD at UBC in interdisciplinary studies, and we've talked a lot about pre-therapy. Like, what are the tools that people need? But they might not even need, formal clinical counseling or therapy, but what can we support people with to help reduce the burden on, those structures and like the medical and the psychological fields, but what can we give people to that they can even do themselves to start supporting themselves if they're interested and ready to take these steps?
Well, I think everybody's toolkit looks very different. I'd love to be able to just see into everybody's toolkit, with how do they, what self-care look like for them? What does, relationship care look like? Those are the things I do believe we try in schools to instill a lot of these strategies in children. However, a lot of those children who need the strategies, move from school to school. They don't have the consistency. They don't have the support of one person in their life to really make sure that they're getting all of the strategies and tools they need for later in life. And if we could really address that and those gaps and having, every child supported somehow, I know it's a pipe dream, but it's good to dream too.
I don't think so. I think like it's a very realistic thing that we could do. We live in one of the richest countries in the world. I don't see why this couldn't be happening.
Well, I think it could be a community endeavor as well. We have big brothers, big sisters. There are so many people who have so much to give to children to support them.
I'm just talking about all the books that I've read today, but I finished reading this book not long ago called The Nordic Theory of Everything. And it was talking about in the Scandinavian countries, their social structures, how basically their support, everyone is supported for well-being, to live a well life. And they talked about different like community resources and resources for children that everybody has access to. So there's no disparity between like who the has and the has nots because everyone has access to these resources. And I feel like that's kind of the issue that can be challenging for kids and likewise parents or even other adults in accessing some of our community resources. There's a stereotype connected to who accesses those resources, which is a big barrier for people to access these resources.
Yes. I even think about free breakfast and free lunch programs in schools. The kids who attend those are often made fun of by the other kids, because it's not equitable as far as all of the kids receiving lunches and breakfasts. And I think that there's so much stigma around, again, the handouts that people talk about, where every child should be given a breakfast and a lunch, and not just those children who are, unable to afford it because they're already, establishing a little bit of a social structure in a building, saying, well, you have to go to the free lunch, you're poor, ha 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 ha. And kids are kids, so it happens. And the kids will stop going to those programs who need the most, and go hungry just to save their, reputation with the other kids.
And likewise, adults, right? Thinking about the different, even the food bank, right? I think that's the grown-up version of the breakfast program that we're talking about. But if everyone has access to the things that they need, then there isn't any disparity or social hierarchy that can exist.
Correct.
So transitioning a little bit, I think we've been talking about a lot of this. Well intended from a place of white individuals. And I'm really curious in mediation work, do you have different people of different ethnicities coming in? And does that mediation process look the same as it does with Caucasian individuals?
Well, I would like to think that I'm culturally responsive. However, I am white. I only know life as a white person. I've always been given that privilege of my skin color. And I would like to think that I would be more open. But again, I don't know really. If I am, that I can be honest that, trying and striving to be culturally competent, that's the best I can do. And, even asking to be called in by people when I'm doing something that's offensive, taking criticism is a huge part of that mindfulness process too. We have to be open. If somebody says you shouldn't say that or do that, I don't think I would be offended. I would be delighted to be enlightened. That's how I see things. But again, I know a lot of people that the threat is real if you are offended, that reptilian brain is it's up. And you're not listening to what they're saying. But yes, we have clients, who are racialized. And but what's interesting, Lexi, is that they're coming in with the same problems as everybody else too. That their families are unique, just as every family's unique. And I think we have to be more attentive to the cultural respect of, and religion, ideals they're bringing with them that maybe I'm not aware of. But definitely just being aware, I don't know. I think sometimes I fail terribly at being a white person, that my job as a white person is to really make sure that other white people are not, continuing oppression.
Why do you say you think you fail terribly then?
I think there's always more that I could be doing. I think I could be making more noise. I'm not much of a talker, Lexi. My mom always makes fun of me as, thinking there was something wrong with me because I didn't talk until I was 4. But I think I'm more of an observer. I watch for patterns, and maybe I need a, more of a soapbox and a big megahorn.
I can arrange that. Yeah,
Oh, okay.
completely. Likewise, I think this is a wonderful soapbox for you to follow through on your duty that you feel as a white person through this podcast.
Well, thank
This
you.
is a great start.
Yes, well, as a white person, I would, encourage all white people to find out what their biases are. And I think there's misconception around the word bias. We are all biased. There's no way we are not biased. And I challenge your listeners who are white to think before they select something on Netflix, when they scan the visuals, why are you not picking something that has a black person on the cover? What is your playlist? What are you reading? We live in segregation as white people. It still exists. What we deem as safe neighborhoods are typically white neighborhoods. And just, really questioning everything we do every day.
There's a famous anthropologist named Franz Boas who described our cultural biases as cultural colored glasses. So kind of like the idea of rose colored glasses, they're your cultured colored glasses. So imagine if you could take off those glasses and see without your biases. Unfortunately, we can't, but we can try. And I think that's a great thing for everything is you're never going to be able to do something perfectly, but you can try at it.
Yes, and I think, and actually, I wrote a paper on this mostly for my own, just fun. It's about humor, using humor as racist. Thinking of ourselves as racist because we are, as white people, we're surrounded, by a racist society, our education system, our legal system, policing. We know that we are living in a, or we should know, we're living in a racist society. What was I saying? I got a little excited there, Lexi.
A paper about humor.
Again, making fun of our mistakes. If we say something and it's wrong, being able to, and I say call someone in to say, hey, that's not, you shouldn't say that. But not, to the extent that you're going to file a complaint against them, but having those direct conversations, don't take it to the next level until you've spoken to the person that you need to speak to. And then, that's where you start, is with the person. Sometimes we bypass the person, but that's a problem. That's how we end up in mediation. That's how we end up in litigation. That's when we have investigations in the workplace, because we don't have those honest conversations. And they're difficult, and that's okay.
I love how this has kind of brought us back to using mindfulness as a suspension of judgment.
Yes, it encapsulates everything we do in life.
That's
Racism, sexism, you name it, ageism.
On that note, I think that brings us wonderfully into our closing question, which is what piece of wisdom can you provide the listeners as they embark on their quest for wholeness?
I had a lot of things written down for that. I think people need to be kind. Always be kind. You don't have to be nice. As women, we're socialized to be nice. I've observed this, people with young daughters who say, be nice. Don't act like that. That's not nice. You're a girl. Don't do that. I don't subscribe to that. I don't think anybody should subscribe to that. Be kind. Don't be nice. When it's not warranted, and enjoy the journey. I think it's okay to speed up, but make sure you're slowing down too. Just taking all of everything that you're doing in life at different speeds, but really engaging and being mindful at every moment that you are awake.
Well, I hope this conversation has encouraged people to practice mindfulness in their daily lives in any which way they can. And I just want to thank you again so much for spending this time with us.
It's been my pleasure, Lexi.
Thank you for joining me on this adventure today. If you're interested in learning more about holistic health or have topics that you'd like to hear on the show, connect with me over on Instagram at Quest for Wholeness Podcast. That's all one word, Quest for Wholeness Podcast. I'll see you next time to continue our shared quest for wholeness.